It's Sunday morning. Time for the Great Outdoors with Charlie Potter. Brought to you by the all-new Chevy Silverado and ChevyDriveChicago.com on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome to the Great Outdoors Show. Charlie Potter, your host here on WGN Radio. And happy Father's Day to all of you dads listening. I hope it's a great day for you and that you have a chance to get into the great outdoors with loved ones or friends and enjoy Father's Day. If you're a shrimp in the Gulf of Maine, something's happened and nobody's quite sure what's going on. But the population of shrimp in the Gulf of Maine, if you can count these, and again, I don't know how these things are counted, but the population of shrimp in the Gulf of Mexico apparently has declined from 27 billion to 2 billion. And they say it's because of the warming waters of the Gulf of Maine, and the northern shrimp population has fallen by, well, it's fallen by 90%. And they think this comes out of the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission. And they say, obviously, the disappearance of the northern shrimp population is alarming. But it goes to show that ocean currents are always moving. And I'm going to have more on this in just a moment. But I guess they take a sample of an area. I've never done this. I've done this with waterfowl. I've done this with fish, but not with shrimp. To go and how you calculate there'd be 27 billion shrimp in the Gulf of Maine, and now you only find almost 3 billion, I guess, is certainly a trend. However many there were to begin with versus now, it's a little bit like the Cornell study on birds, which said we've lost 3 billion birds in the last 25 years. Whether we've lost 3 billion, 300 million, or whatever the number, the trend line is absolutely terrible. But changing Gulf ocean currents is something that happens all the time. And later this summer, I will do the show, as I always have, from the coast of Maine, and we'll talk about lobstering, and I hopefully will have John Doherty on the air again to talk about what's taking place in the lobster world. But lobsters are walking north, and maybe it's that shrimp are walking north too, and maybe they're walking to areas where they haven't been researched before, or they're taking up new residence. And this is part of what I talk a lot about is that nature is not static. It's always changing, and species since evolution have either evolved or they've perished. And there was an article recently in Forbes about the sturgeon in the Snake River of Idaho, and here's how one of the oldest species on Earth goes back to the dinosaurs, prehistoric. It's evolved and it's survived. Obviously, there are an awful lot of species that have not evolved. And in recent times, there are also species like the passenger pigeon, which we drove into extinction. They didn't have a chance to evolve. But it's possible the northern Maine shrimp population's further north. That's what they're finding with lobster. They're now catching lobster in the lobster wars between Canada and the United States up in Lebec, Maine, and on further north are very real. And lobstering was not a big deal up there 25, 30 years ago, certainly 40 years ago, but now it's a huge deal. And the lobster that were off of Massachusetts are no longer there. The lobstermen are out of business. The lobstermen in southern Maine are having to go out further for lobster. All this has to do with the ocean currents. But they also think that there are more lobster in the ocean now than there were 50 years ago off the coast of Maine. They're just in different places. Smallmouth bass. The St. Lawrence Seaway is loaded with smallmouth bass. And they have moved in because of the warming waters. Of course, smallmouth bass are sitting at the mouth of all these famous salmon rivers, the Miramichi, and I could go on and on and on the famous salmon rivers where smallmouth bass are just sitting at the mouth of these rivers, just waiting for the smolt to come down so they can eat them. Or they're actually moving up into the pools of some of these rivers and living there. So the fabulous Atlantic salmon fishing rivers that we've known about for the last 150 years that have been the story of legends and fabulous fishing camps and so many conservation stories are being now, they're becoming smallmouth bass camps. People don't want to catch the smallmouth bass, so many of the fishing camps are closing down. But the reality is nature's always changing. And when we do population dynamics, we assume it's static. I mean, I'll take an example of the wood duck. The wood duck, when it was originally surveyed, was a bird that was found only, according to studies, in the United States, in the lower 48 states. There were no wood ducks breeding on the prairies. There were, I think there were basically none breeding in the Dakotas either, but wood ducks were believed to be in the United States and for the most part, almost entirely east of the Mississippi River. Well, about 40 years ago, people began to see wood ducks breeding in southern Canada and all the way up into the almost the boreal forest. They're breeding up in the Pa and the Cumberland houses in some numbers. That was 40 years ago. Today, wood ducks are a common breeding bird all through the parklands of Manitoba, all the way up in the Pa. Wood ducks are extremely common for breeding. There were none there in the 1950s that anyone ever heard of. So they have moved as habitats have adapted. Maybe it's climate, maybe it's different habitat. Wood ducks also were historically among the first ducks to migrate south. Now people are seeing wood ducks and hunting wood ducks into the latest of seasons in the northern states. They aren't migrating as much. So the wood duck is an example of a species that's adapted. Certainly the Canada geese, we've talked about this, have adapted, snow geese, etc. So when we read that things are falling off the cliff, they might be for some species, but other species are going to be adapting and filling those voids and maybe even doing better. So nature, as I think we all know, is always in a state of flux. And I could cite for many mornings in a row stories of species that have adapted and thrived either because of a warming climate where they live, a cooling climate, or because of their adaptation to humans and what humans have done to the landscape. So moving on from that, I want to talk for a moment about rhino poaching in Africa before I go to the break. There is a growing belief that the best way to control rhino poaching is to cut off the horns of a rhinoceros. And many of you might be recoiling at that thought, thinking how cruel, etc. The reality is the great horn of a rhinoceros is a little bit like a fingernail. It just keeps growing, and as long as you don't cut it down into the quick and get into the nerves, the animal doesn't seem to notice it at all. So if you cut off the horn of a rhinoceros, which has an aphrodisiac value still in China and throughout Asia, that's where the poaching is driven from. If you cut that horn off, then the rhino's life is chances are the rhino is going to be saved because it doesn't have the value of the horn for aphrodisiacs. The problem is you have to do it about every 18 months or so, because it keeps growing back. Just as I said, it's like a fingernail, just keeps growing back. So what they are finding in Africa is one of the most effective ways to shut down the poaching of rhinoceroses is to cut off the horns of the rhinoceros. Gruesome as that sounds, it's saving the lives of rhinoceroses. And if you go and now talk to a number of conservation groups in Africa, that is their number one mode of controlling the decline of rhinoceros. They cannot seem to get their arms around the poaching rings, which are highly sophisticated, from planes to radios to drones to all the things that modern military groups use. They have not been able to really stop the rhinoceros poaching. But when you take away the value of the horn, the aphrodisiac is gone, if you will, then poachers won't target them. So that's what's happening in Africa. As sad as it is, it does appear as though we've found some way to at least temporarily reduce the kill of rhinoceros. I'll be back in just a moment. And when I do, I'm going to come back and talk about what's happening with possibility of sale of federal lands and what some people think about it, positively and negatively. Hard to find people who think it's a great idea, but we'll talk about that when I come back. This is Charlie Potter on the Outdoor Voice of Chicago and America, 720 WGN. And first, a message from our longtime sponsors, the Northwest Indiana and Chicagoland Chevrolet dealers.
Hiking, camping, and hunting, it's all an adventure in the great outdoors, but nature can be tough. You need to be ready for anything and everything. Chevy Silverado is built to handle the toughest conditions and get you everywhere you want to go, worry-free. Silverado's designed to handle the big jobs. It's built for the great outdoors. With over 13,000 pounds of towing capacity and trailering sway control, Silverado can haul the biggest loads on the roughest roads and keep you cool as a Sunday drive. With 8 available cameras and up to 14 different views, it can spot trouble before it gets to you. That's peace of mind. And when you're ready for the backcountry, Chevy Silverado 1500 ZR2 owns the off-road. You name it, we run over it. No wonder it's Motor Trend's 2023 four-wheeler pickup truck of the year. So see your Chicagoland and Northwest Indiana Chevy dealer or go to ChevyDriveChicago.com and check out a Chevy Silverado. It's freedom to explore the great outdoors.
It's Charlie Potter and the Great Outdoors on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the Great Outdoors Show. Charlie Potter, your host here on WGN Radio, and I hope you're enjoying the show. Headline is Congressional Sportsman's Foundation opposes Senate push to arbitrarily sell off federal public lands. A couple weeks ago, the House of Representatives successfully defeated a bill under this quote-unquote Reconciliation Act, or as it's more commonly known, the One Big Beautiful Bill, to include the sale of federal lands in the bill, with the revenues going from those sales into the general tax code, and changing the process, which has been set up for many years, on how federal lands are distributed. The Senate is now taking this up, and there is a strong push from some Western senators to include in the reconciliation bill that federal lands, a minimum of 2 million acres and up to 3 million acres of federal lands, should be sold to help reduce the federal deficit and to make communities more viable where there's an overabundance of federal lands, therefore opening up lands for development, for housing, for commercial uses, for recreational uses in the private sector, et cetera, to stimulate the economy and in many places to give people places to live. In the West, in a lot of areas that have so much federal land, the populations are squeezed into the valleys that is all private, and therefore by opening up some federal lands, they would enable people to have housing. There's a lot to dissect here, and it should not be done under a reconciliation bill that's going to be thousands of pages long. Whether you think it's a good idea or not is really not the question this morning. Personally, I think it's a lousy idea to sell federal lands. I think it's a very good idea to trade federal lands for private lands, to block up federal lands so that there is more contiguous federal land access, and the same for private landowners. If you look across the American West, it's called checkerboarding. It looks exactly like a checkerboard. You got a private landowner, and then a federal landowner, and then a private landowner, et cetera. And that's just the way the land was cut up with the railroads and when it was settled. It would be very helpful to break that down and to find strategic parcels that should be blocked up either as federal land or as private land, and to do it under land trades. Once the land leaves the federal payroll and either goes to the states or goes off to auction, it's not coming back. Now, I could also offer that there are federal lands, BLM, Bureau of Land Management, and Forest Service in particular. There probably are lands in some areas that could or should be sold off that have very little value from a recreational or wildlife point of view. And if that's the case, then probably we entertain it. But it's not 2 to 3 million acres. It could be a few thousand. It could be 10,000. But that's about it. Maybe a little more. But and no one, by the way, has ever done a study on that. But if you're a mountain town butting up against federal lands and you have no room to grow, and those federal lands have very little recreation or wildlife value, a lot of BLM lands have those cases. Then maybe it's fine. But what's not going to be fine is to put those proceeds into the federal treasury. Instead, they've always gone, whenever federal lands have been sold, and it's a very burdensome process to sell an acre of federal lands, those revenues have always gone into a conservation fund for the acquisition and management of federal lands. This reconciliation bill changes that. There would not be an opportunity for those funds to go into the coffers of conservation anymore. They go back into the general treasury. So we'll see what happens. I think it's highly unlikely that this gets through the Congress, but it shouldn't be part of reconciliation anyway. It should be part of an open discussion as to a strategy for our federal lands. And I don't think any of us like, in the dark of night, whether we live in, you know, look at Illinois, what happens in Springfield at the 12th hour. We don't like these kind of things. And particularly for sportsmen and women who rely on federal lands for access, we want to know what lands might be up, even for consideration, before they would go through with some kind of sale. My guess is they don't know what kind of lands. You can only imagine the political chicanery that's going to take place if this were to go through, and who would line up to get options on pieces of property, etc. It's a mess. It's a mess we don't need. The Congressional Sportsman's Foundation is right. Just simply don't do it. It's not what we're going to do to help the federal treasury by selling off our national treasures. And if you don't think that that worked out well for the Chicago, for the Skyway, for those of you who remember what was done here a number of years ago, it's no different for federal lands. We'll never get it back. And about the minute I have left, and it is literally that, also there's a discussion about buying out long-term conservation easements. Landowners, the discussion is letting landowners come in and buy back property that they put into long-term conservation easements so that it could be returned to farming. I also don't think that's going anywhere, but it does give you a general sense that there is an attempt to undo some very significant conservation gains. And when you signed a conservation easement and put your land in that, it was in perpetuity. And I'm constantly reminded perpetuity is a long time. So I don't think we want to change things that our forefathers or even we might have done recently to protect the most valuable lands just because now it looks like it's most valuable ecological lands, just because it can be put to use now to grow some more grain. And one more thing is before we sign off, and that is this discussion of R3, this discussion about recruit, retain, and reactivate people who hunt. More and more, and the government has spent, and states have spent a tremendous amount of money on this program. It's looking like it's a program whose objectives are clouded, and without clear objectives, it's going to be hard to measure success. If the program is designed to have more people come into hunting, it's not going to work. And it has not worked. And the tens of millions, if not more, that have been spent on this to date have demonstrated that recruiting more hunters with a population that's ever urbanizing is not going to happen. Even if we stayed flat with the same number of hunters we have now, we're going to lose as a percentage of the population. What a lot of very smart people are saying is, wait a minute, the point of R3 should not be to recruit more hunters. The point of R3 should be to have society accept the rights of people to hunt and to do so in an ethical way. And for those people who want to go hunting, to have the opportunity to have places to go hunting. The number one key here and the biggest change being driven is society accepting hunting as part of our heritage. And a lot of you listening will say, of course it does. It's what we do. There are an awful lot of organizations that in America today are driven solely to try to put people who hunt out of business because they don't think hunting should be continued. So R3, well-intentioned, but it's not proving to be terribly effective. And there could be a lot better ways to spend that money. If society doesn't support hunting, hunting's going to end. Doesn't matter what else we do. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next Sunday morning, and happy Father's Day to all of you. Hope you have a great day and a great week in the great outdoors. This is Charlie Potter on the Outdoor Voice of Chicago and America, 720 WGN.